Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Ryan Sykoski of Womble, Carlisle, Sandridge, and Rice, on behalf of the appellant, Gianfranco Carta, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
And as a matter of courtesy, before we begin, I'd like to introduce counsel today, Mark DeGrosse, my colleague at Womble, Carlisle.
Welcome.
As well as Richard Morse of the American...
Always good to see you.
And you're familiar with Richard Morse.
You can raise that podium a little bit if you need to.
Hard to hear you.
Is this better?
Sure.
A little bit better?
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. The court is well versed in the facts of this case, so my intention, unless the court directs otherwise, is to address that very briefly and then move into briefly go through the procedural posture of this case and then move directly to the argument. In this case, the actions that give rise to this case arise from the night of September 29, 2009, when Mr. Carta was arrested on suspicion of shoplifting. That charge was later dropped, but he was detained for one evening at the Sussex Correctional Institution, which I'll refer to as SCI for the rest of this argument. During that overnight stay, Mr. Carta was allegedly abused by SCI guards, and I don't think it's necessary to go into the specific allegations of the details of the alleged abuse now for purposes of this argument, but suffice it to say, in the words of the trial court, he alleges that he was assaulted. As a result of those actions, Mr. Carta filed a complaint that was later amended, which is the basis of this appeal. In his original complaint, he named three defendants, two of which are before the court today. They're Carl Danberg, who serves as the actions in this complaint, as the Commissioner of Delaware's Department of Corrections, as well as Michael Deloy, who is the warden at SCI. And in the words of the trial court, both of these individuals are supervisory officials.
Is there a separate lawsuit against the alleged perpetrators of this abuse, or they're just not before any court?
Specific guards are not before any court at this time. There is no separate lawsuit against them. The lawsuit was brought against Danberg and Deloy in their individual capacities as supervisory officials. And in that capacity, Mr. Carta's amended complaint alleged that they had actual knowledge of that inmates were being, that there were alleged assaults taking place at SCI, that they did nothing in the face of that. He also alleged that they failed to train their subordinates, the guards, that were the direct cause of Mr. Carta's injuries, and that failure to train can be imputed to them under a theory of supervisory liability. Had they adequately taken steps to train the guards, the conduct that took place at the prison that night may never have happened. And that those two facts were alleged in the amended complaint. The state did not answer the amended complaint and elected to file a motion to dismiss pursuant to Rule 12b-6 for failure to state a claim. The trial court reviewed that under the correct pleading standard, which is Delaware's conceivability standard. But in the end dismissed the amended complaint for failure to state a claim.
All right, so what was erroneous about the dismissal of the complaint?
What was erroneous about the dismissal of the complaint, Your Honor, and to bring you right into the argument, is on page 6 of the dismissal, the judge wrote, bearing in mind the standard of liability under 42 U.S.C. section 1983, described above, which applies to the defendants in this case, I conclude that the existence of a few cases of alleged inmate abuse over the period of time involved here, except it is true, is, without more, insufficient to plead a claim against the defendants upon which relief can be granted under 42 U.S.C. section 1983.
Right. Well, we know he found there was no claim. The question is, why is it error?
The answer to the question is that statement alone is error under, for purposes of a motion to dismiss in the amended complaint. The amended complaint alleges that the defendants had knowledge, that they acquiesced to their subordinates' violation, and lists a laundry list of factual allegations in paragraphs 30, 31, 42, and 43.
Well, as I understood your brief, your argument is if we accept as true that there were a few prior cases of abuse, then your cause of action is conceivable, and that the error of law is to assume that there were a few prior cases, but a few prior cases are not enough to satisfy the conceivability standard.
That's correct, Justice Holland. That is the original, that is the foundation of the argument, that the existence of other complaints of alleged complaints of inmate abuse without more is enough to satisfy the standard. But the amended complaint goes beyond that. It also addresses specific facts in terms of the additional cases to begin with are were described in the amended complaint as instances in which trial counsel was aware that there were similar cases that had been brought. That wasn't the entire sum universe of...
How does that establish that there, in fact, was abuse, and in fact, that there was knowledge by the commissioner and the warden of actual abuse? Doesn't it merely establish that someone's complained of abuse?
It does establish that someone has complained of abuse previously, but part of a supervisory liability claim in the Third Circuit, and we cited the Third Circuit case in our briefs, part of making that claim is looking at a supervisor's tolerance of past misconduct. In other words, in supervisory liability cases, it's common to see prior allegations, other cases detailing similar allegations.
Justice, assuming what you said is a correct statement of the law, Justice Ridgely's question is, prior cases of misconduct, as you have described it, versus prior cases of alleged misconduct. So if we had a few prior cases of established misconduct, that would be one standard to look at conceivability. But if we only have a few cases of prior alleged misconduct, maybe that's different. So which does your complaint fall into?
Well, I think, Your Honor, and I hope I'm answering Your Honor's question and Justice Ridgely's question, that you certainly can draw a distinction between cases where there was a trial on the merits and there was cases where misconduct was affirmatively found and cases where there were allegations of inmate abuse. All right, the point, I think it's important to recall that we're on the motion to dismiss stage. It's just the pleading stage, which in Delaware, which is a notice state, requires enough information to put a defendant on notice of the claims against them. And the amended complaint, read as a whole and taking all inferences in favor of the non-moving party, which is the appellant, can be read that there is actual knowledge. There are some other cases where there have been allegations and that in discovery that additional factual support will be presented. But for purposes of a motion to dismiss, the critical allegation is that there was knowledge, that they knew of at least these cases, and that taken together with the specific policies and the specific actions identified in the complaint, the failure to correct certain actions in terms of correcting, for example, the amended complaint is specific about correcting blind spots where inmates are alleged.
Your claim is not that the defendants knew about the alleged physical violence that took place in Mr. Carter's case.
That's correct.
But rather that they knew that there were claims of misconduct in three other cases where complaints had been filed.
That at least that much, correct.
And just to jump ahead for a minute, if let's assume that that does state a cause of action, and a court determined that you were entitled to relief on that claim, what relief would you be seeking precisely?
The amended complaint seeks damages against the individual defendants.
Personal injury damages?
I think the trial, the brief is just says general damages. I believe so. General damages.
It's not a claim for institutional equitable relief, imposing some sort of training program.
Well, right. So I think it's important. That's an important distinction. There's theories of what's known as municipality liability.
Answer my question. It's not an equitable remedy case. It's a damage.
It's a damages case. That's
and
right.
The damages would be personal to Mr. Carter.
That's right.
Okay.
Right. The damages would be personal to Mr. Carter, but they flow from again the commissioner and the warden, and the commissioner in particular, is under a statutory obligation, and as the trial court found, to supervise the conditions of the prison.
So the claim in the complaint that there had been failures to train guards properly is simply evidentiary. What's the relevance of it?
Well, the failure to train claim goes to, had the guards been trained adequately, then the actions that the guards took would have likely been ameliorated. For example, there are specific allegations in the complaint about the use of capstone, and then there are corollary allegations, the fact that the guards were not trained in its use. And so the capstone was sprayed, allegedly, very close to Mr. Carter, causing part of the injury. And if there had been training, sufficient training on its use, as well as several other instances.
The reason I ask is that if there was in effect a policy that you don't physically abuse inmates, that would be enough to generate a claim for damages, would it not?
If there was an effective policy and it wasn't being followed or enforced?
Correct.
Yes, that's
your claim.
That's
part of your claim.
It's part of the claim, right.
Okay, so if that's the case, then whether or not these abusive guards were trained wouldn't matter from a legal standpoint, would it?
I think it would matter.
Why?
Well, because this is a supervisory liability claim. The defendants are responsible for supervising and for training the guards, and in the briefs we've cited cases for the proposition that the failure to train in the face of or enact policies where inmates are being harmed and where the supervisor knew or should have known that the failure to train would result in a constitutional deprivation at the hands of their guards or employees, that in itself is a cause of action.
So as I understand it, although the briefs allude to the Thompson case decided by the United States Supreme Court a couple of years ago involving Brady violations in the District Attorney of New Orleans, and otherwise talks about immunity or limited immunity, none of that's really relevant to this appeal. The question is, does the complaint withstand a motion to dismiss? And to the extent it does, liability or immunity are defenses that you deal with after the complaint moves forward?
That is a much better way of phrasing it than I think I've been able to. That's exactly right. This the important I think the essence of this appeal is that this is a motion to dismiss, that qualified immunity and other immunities are defenses that can be established, that are typically established on summary judgment or after facts have been, more facts have come to light. The state does reference qualified immunity at several points in its brief, and that's certainly, nothing in this appeal forecloses it, but them from raising it at an appropriate time, but the trial court's decision did not speak to qualified immunity. That's simply not before the court today. What's before the court today is a motion to dismiss based on the trial court's determination without without referencing the training aspect of the case and the conclusion that additional cases without more, even in the face of knowledge and acquiescence being pleaded, it is not a possibility that a claim can be made in that case under Delaware's notice pleading standard.
So, in essence, we're back to the question that we started with, and that is, if you can allege incidents of prior misconduct, whether they're alleged or actual, that should be enough to support the conceivability standard to withstand a motion to dismiss and permit you to take discovery.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. Again, I know I keep repeating this, but again, in Delaware, the purpose of a motion to dismiss and the purpose of notice pleading is to ensure that the defendants have enough notice to make a defense and to understand what the claims that we're making are. And the claims are that they had knowledge, that they did nothing, that they failed to train, and discovery will go a long way in proving that out. And the merits of that and qualified immunity and all these other issues are for another day.
This is a Section 1983 federal claim.
That's correct.
And as I understand it, there's concurrent jurisdiction, both in terms of, well, for both the federal and the state courts to entertain those claims.
That's correct.
So this claim could have been brought in federal court, yet it wasn't. Just curious as to why. Am I missing something here?
Your Honor, I can't speculate. I'm not certain what trial counsel's rationale for bringing the case in state court was. But you are absolutely correct. These cases are more often than not brought in federal court.
Most of the law in this area has been federal.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that's right. And I think that also, to some extent, and perhaps I'll save most of my time for rebuttal on this point, but some of the standards that are cited by the state in its brief are federal cases, which are taken into account a different standard of review. Iqbal, for example, is a Bivens case with a different...
Okay, so one argument, one reason might be you want to avoid Iqbal. All right, I mean, I understand that.
All right.
Although there are some judges who think there's no difference between the conceivability standard and the
plausibility.
You agree that conclusory allegations do not need to be accepted by the trial court?
I do agree with that, Your Honor.
Why isn't this allegation of knowledge conclusory?
No, it's not conclusory because when read as a whole with the rest of the complaint, when you look at the complaint and all the allegations as a whole, the complaint goes into detail as to beyond that there were additional, at least allegations of similar nature taking place. There are also specific training examples and specific deficient policies that have been enacted that give rise to an inference that there was no action taken and that there was knowledge. And whether or not that turns out to be the case down the line is another story, but when you read the complaint as a whole under Delaware standard and you take all inferences in favor of the non-moving party, it's not a conclusory allegation. I think if you look at the allegations as a whole and the specificity.
Well, even if the allegation of knowledge is not conclusory, it is the case, is it not, that the underlying facts that are being pled here are not established facts, they're allegations.
That's correct.
Why isn't that conclusory?
That the underlying facts are allegations, because they're... what is a conclusory allegation, I think... conclusory allegations are typically, you see, in the context of a threadbare recitation simply of the elements of a claim. I think, again, if looking at this... the entire complaint.
I'm not sure I understand where you're going. Just tell me why they're not conclusory. You know, all you're doing is saying that the knowledge that the defendants had consisted of information that complaints had been filed on behalf of three other persons who in their own cases alleged physical abuse.
Well, at least those other cases. Again, it's when you are seeking to prove a supervisor's action or perhaps inaction at the pleading stage, It's somewhat difficult to do without the benefit of discovery. What we've raised is a fair inference, and again, the standard is knowledge, acquiescence, and a connection between the two, and we feel that a fair reading of the complaint should lead to the conclusion that the trial court should be reversed and that the case should proceed at the trial level. Thank Unless the court has any questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning again.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ryan Connell, and along with my co-counsel, Deborah Scott, we represent the defendants in this matter. I'd like to start by just saying there is no supervisory liability in 1983 actions against state officials. It is established law that a defendant in civil rights action must have personal involvement in the alleged wrongs to be liable and cannot be held responsible for constitutional violations which he neither participated in or approved. As my opposing counsel went on at length, he admits this is a supervisory liability claim against our defendants. That just cannot stand under the established law here. Personal involvement, as Iqbal makes clear, is a touchstone for establishing liability in a 1983 action.
Is that established law established by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And we're dealing with the constitutional law of the United States, so that is the law of the land on this. It is also established that
are we talking about constitutional law or the interpretation of a federal statute?
Well, 1983 is a federal statute that allows for constitutional claims to be brought. So it is substantive law. It's not procedural law on these points.
And so what's the leading case that supports your position?
I'd say Iqbal is the most recent recitation of it. However, it's not really a change. I mean, the Third Circuit goes back to cases like Rode, and it's well established. It's a long history. I think Iqbal really just kind of has reestablished.
There are a lot of Iqbal cases. Are you referring to the one that created the plausibility standard?
Iqbal versus Ashcroft, that's correct. Iqbal versus Ashcroft, that's correct. It is the one that did talk about the plausibility standard. But
and that was a Bivens case.
That was a Bivens case, Your Honor. But there's also established case law that in the federal court system that Bivens cases are analogous to 1983 actions against state actors because they generally follow the same. Whereas 1983 is statutory, Bivens is a judicially created cause of action, but they're both actions in which you bring constitutional claims against government actors.
Was that
and therefore the...
I'm sorry. Was that the basis on which Judge Vaughn ruled?
Judge Vaughn did not rule on the Iqbal plausibility standard, but he did rule on the substantive law.
I understand he didn't rule on the plausibility standard, but if the short answer is that the only way you get into court under 1983 is to make well-founded allegations that the, in this case, the commissioner and the warden were personally involved somehow in the alleged physical abuse, then you don't have a 1983 claim. That would have been a paragraph-long opinion. Did the trial court hold that?
Well, Your Honor, my understanding is that Judge Vaughn used Delaware's conceivability standard, the lowest bar here, and he looked at the facts as pleaded and found that under no circumstance could those facts support an allegation of personal involvement. There's no personal involvement. There's no actual knowledge.
Yes, personal involvement. He did hold that personal involvement is required, and the complaint didn't allege personal involvement.
That would be correct. That would be my he touched on a number of things in his opinion, but my understanding is that given all the facts as pleaded in the complaint, it could not possibly support, under the substantive law, it could not possibly support this claim for relief.
Well, let's suppose in the complaint alleged and there were 10 prior incidents of abuse, and they were evidenced by jury verdicts that had all become final. Would that be enough to satisfy the conceivability standard?
No, Your Honor, because although they plead that it's an actual knowledge case, what is or what they're arguing now is that they pleaded actual knowledge. What they actually set out in the complaint is a constructive notice claim. Constructive notice cannot support a claim for 1983 liability. So regardless of whether these were jury verdicts or mere lawsuits or just allegations in the newspaper, that's creating a constructive notice claim that Carl Danberg should
have. If it was a defendant in one of the cases, that wouldn't be constructive notice, would it?
Well, Your Honor, the mere fact of being a defendant is not, that puts you on notice that there are allegations out there, but this doesn't put you on notice that there's actual wrongdoing. And
I'm a little lost here. What difference does it make if there's actual or constructive notice? The complaint alleges that these two defendants had actual notice that there were complaints made in three other cases.
Well,
I thought that what your argument was is that unless the defendants were personally involved in this case, then there is no claim under 1883. Did I misunderstand you?
That would be correct. Or there could be personal actual knowledge and acquiescence. But actual knowledge means you have to actually be there. You have to know that something is happening to that plaintiff. It's not alleged that Carl Danberg knew what was happening to Gianfranco Carta and did nothing or gave the okay.
It's not alleged that Carl Danberg knew what was happening in the other three cases either, or just in this case?
It's not enough for him to know, or maybe should have known, that something happened in other cases. He has to know. Actual knowledge and actual acquiescence requires him to know what is happening to the plaintiff, and that was not pleaded in this case.
Well, it was pled that he had actual knowledge that a culture of violence existed at SCI, in which COs without justification frequently physically abused inmates who displeased them in any way, especially if the inmates were smaller and weaker than them or impaired by intoxication. Is that sentence a sufficient allegation of fact, or is it conclusory?
Well, onto the second point, it is certainly conclusory. And one of the main problems here is they've made this conclusory allegation that he is aware of a culture of violence, and they've based a conclusory statement on other conclusory allegations. The existence of lawsuits filed by the same trial counsel, not lawsuits that have gone to judgment.
But let's go back to the pleading standard. What Judge Vaughn said is, I will assume for purposes of this motion to dismiss that there were three prior cases of violence. That's not enough.
No, Your Honor, that's not.
Well, that's what he said. And my question is, as a matter of law, if you have three prior cases of violence that are assumed to be true, why doesn't that satisfy the conceivability standard?
Well, that would satisfy the conceivability standard that there were three incidences of violence, but three incidences of unrelated violence cannot support a lawsuit against Carl Danberg in this matter. He would have had to have actual knowledge of Mr. Carta's plight, then done nothing. Well, that would have been
Mr. Carta's theory of the case is, this would have never happened to me if you'd have taken timely corrective action after the first three cases. I mean, if the standard is they needed to know that something, that, you know, pepper spray was being used on Mr. Carta or whatever else is alleged to have happened to him that night, that would be an impossible standard. So that's why his theory is, whatever happened to me should not and would not have happened to me if you'd taken corrective action after the three cases that are assumed to be true.
That's correct, Your Honor. They make a failure to train argument that had Mr. Danberg properly trained, they don't even make a failure to train. They make a failure to train the way we want you to train our officers claim. But beyond that, there's no cause of action for failure to train that can be asserted against state officers. All of the cases that they cite are Monell cases against municipalities and counties. And there's a big difference between a Monell case and a 1983 action that is brought against state officials.
Well, let's assume you're right. There's no failure to train case. The other allegation in the complaint is failure to supervise. So, hypothetically, you could have someone who was trained perfectly and simply disregarded the training. And if the perfectly trained individual's disregarding the training, then you have a supervision problem, and that's what they're alleging.
That would be correct, and it's established law that you simply cannot hold supervisory officials liable for that.
Well, but that's a defense, and that's where I'm trying to understand your argument, and that's what I was saying to Mr. Sikosky. For him, this may be a Pyrrhic victory. He withstands a motion to dismiss, and you have affirmative defenses that are dispositive. But we're not talking about your defenses yet. We're talking about granting the motion to dismiss.
Right, Your Honor. We are discussing what is within the four corners of the complaint. And our position is simply that there's nothing that they can put within the four corners of a complaint that would support a cause for supervisory liability, because it's established law that supervisors cannot be held liable for failing to properly supervise their underlings.
And that's the beginning and the end of your case, isn't it, or your argument?
It really is, Your Honor.
Well, I'm trying to understand how that relates to being a liability argument or immunity argument. If you look at the Thompson case, what was going on in New Orleans is they were able to establish that the prosecutors weren't trained to produce Brady material. As a result of the non-production of the Brady material, a defendant was wrongly convicted, and he brought a cause of action, and the allegation was there was a systemic problem relating to failure to train and supervise that gave rise to this liability. The United States Supreme Court, 5-4, concluded that there was immunity. Now, concluding there was immunity is different than saying there was no cause of action. Do you see the distinction I'm trying to get you to come to grips with?
Well, Your Honor, I would like to point out that there's a distinction between Connick in this case. Connick is also a Monell case. Connick, we did put that in our brief as sort of a fallback position. But Connick is a DA. He was not an employee of the state. So in that case, they were able to bring a Monell action against that district attorney. Our position is that this is simply not something you can bring against a state official.
But
that
when
said,
the case went to the United States Supreme Court, they weren't looking to the individual district attorney. They were looking at the municipality to respond. So they were looking for an institutional response. But let's put that aside, and let's assume I understand the distinctions. My question for you is, even if you have a valid immunity defense, is that your argument in the motion to dismiss the complaint?
Well, our number one argument is that this simply is not a cause of action under 1983.
And what is missing?
Well, I don't believe that there could be anything added to it, because as they admit, they're seeking a supervisory cause of action. There's nothing missing. They're seeking a supervisory action, and that's simply, under the substantive law, that's something that can't occur.
So, hypothetically then, if a commissioner of corrections did nothing to train anybody, had actual knowledge of all kinds of violence happening in the institution, that there would be no liability, even under that worst case scenario. That's your position? Do I understand it correctly?
In a failure to train, he can't be liable. If he has actual knowledge of a wrongdoing to a particular individual, that's actual knowledge. There may be a cause of action for if he has personal knowledge and he acquiesces. There's a big and in there. So Carl would have to know of a violation against a certain individual and then just turn the other cheek or tell those officers that's okay.
So he'd have to know it was actually going to happen or was in progress before he could be liable?
That's correct. He would have to know of an ongoing, perhaps, we see a lot of claims where an inmate will say, well, you know, I've been in this repeated pattern of abuse by officer so-and-so. And, you know, even the district court even screens those. These types of court claims appear repeatedly in the U.S. district court, often pleaded with a lot more specificity than this.
We need to understand your argument, and you're saying supervisory claims are specific to the individual plaintiff. And it doesn't matter that the same thing happened to 10 people before you. That's not a cause of action for failure to supervise. The only cause of action you can have is if you can show something bad happened to you today, you made the commissioner aware of it, and then it happened to you tomorrow. But whatever happened to those 10 people before you does not give rise to a cause of action for failure to supervise.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's constructive notice, and that's not a cause of action under 1983.
Well, suppose that there was a meeting, and they said to the commissioner, you know, we've got these 10 people who all have valid claims for unprovoked violence. Actual knowledge in my hypothetical. And then Carter has a similar thing happen to him. Is the fact that there was actual knowledge of those 10 prior claims relevant to a claim for failure to supervise?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I guess I don't understand the hypothetical. Who had a meeting and what was the reporting? What was told to Carl Danberg?
The commissioner was told directly. We've had 10 documented acts of improper violence. He has actual knowledge. They're not allegations. Everybody agrees. There's a pattern of violence at SCI documented in 10 cases. Then Mr. Carter comes into the system. The same thing happens to him that happened to those 10 other people. And in the interim, the commissioner's done nothing. My question is there a claim for failure to supervise or not?
No, Your Honor, there would not be. But let me explain further. I believe my client, Mr. Danberg, would concede that he would have a professional duty to do something there. However, a professional duty is not a legal duty, and there would be no legal cause of action against him for
Mr.
Carter.
Well, that's the question is, why isn't there a 1983 violation? And I haven't heard a clear, crisp answer in the hypothetical that Justice Holland raised, which is that there's a pattern and practice of guards inflicting physical violence on different people. That's undisputed. It's undisputed that Mr. Danberg knew about that, but did nothing to ameliorate it, either by proper supervision or proper training. And then after all of those events take place, one day later or one week later, Mr. Carter enters the system and the same thing happens to him. Why is that not a viable claim under Section 1983?
Because that lacks the requisite personal involvement on the behalf of Mr. Danberg with respect to the harm that would befall Mrs. Carter.
Precisely what? What would Mr. Danberg have to have done in order for him to be subject to Section 1983 liability?
Well, Your Honor, our position is that if a supervisor is there and they witness violence, that's actual knowledge. And then if that supervisor does nothing from that point,
okay, so he's a witness. He either is involved personally in the violence or he stands in the corner and watches other people do it, has the power to stop them, but does nothing.
Right, Your Honor. So our position would be that sometimes supervisors in a more rank-and-file position might have some sort of liability. If, say, a sergeant is there with a correctional officer, that particular officer is applying force to an individual, and they do nothing.
So the issue, I guess, is whether your contention that Mr. Danberg would have had to physically witnessed the violence that took place in connection with this plaintiff as a requirement of stating a claim under 1983.
Right, Your Honor. I might concede that perhaps in a case of an ongoing pattern of neglect, if, say, Mr. Carter had been imprisoned for a long period of time and had, you know, maybe somehow brought this to Mr. Danberg's attention repeatedly and Mr. Danberg did nothing, perhaps that would be a cause of action. But Mr. Danberg would have needed to have been aware of Mr. Carter's predicament in order to have the requisite actual knowledge to support a 1983 claim against
and
him.
And what is the case that you rely upon for there that proposition?
Well, Your Honor, that proposition of the personal involvement is repeated in numerous cases. I mean, you can, that proposition stands in Iqbal. You can look at Baraka versus McGreevy. I don't believe that was cited in our brief, but the cite for that is 481 Federal 3rd 187. It's also repeated in numerous district court screening cases. One is Dickens versus Danberg. That's 2012 Westlaw 2089516. I can give you a bunch of other district court screening opinions.
You're saying there's cases like this one in the district court that have been dismissed for the reasons you've argued?
Your Honor, I see my time is up.
You can answer my question.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor. These cases show up repeatedly in the district court, often with more pleading than this.
Did you cite any of those in your brief?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I didn't think about this argument until I was preparing for the oral argument on this.
Well, don't you see that as problematic when we get to the end of the argument and we ask you to tell us the cases that are dispositive in support of your position, and you start giving us citations for the first time?
I wouldn't rely on these cases so much for the fact that these district court screening opinions are dispositive. I would just rely on these cases to show the existence that this is something that is routinely argued and routinely dismissed.
But don't you see the problem we have in completely understanding that argument if we don't have the cases to read?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't want you to rely on them as dispositive. I think the Third Circuit and the Supreme Court matters on this, the U.S. Supreme Court decisions on this speak for themselves. I didn't want to get bogged down on district court screening decisions.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Sikorski, you used up all of your time, but we helped you. So we'll give you 1 minute if you have something you'd like to say.
Thank you. I'll see if I can do it more quickly than the 1 minute. Much of the state's argument centered on whether or not a supervisory official can be held liable without knowing the harm that would befall a specific inmate. The case cited in our brief is the United States Supreme Court case Farmer versus Brennan, and that's 511 U.S. 825 is on page 2 of the reply brief, and the parenthetical reads, under the test we adopt today, an Eighth Amendment claimant need not show that a prison official acted or failed to act believing that harm actually would befall an inmate. It is enough that the official acted or failed to act despite his knowledge of a substantial risk of serious harm. That goes to the supervisory and systemic nature of this. And personal involvement is knowledge and acquiescence, and that's what's been alleged in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.